Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Gist for Freedom of Faith. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Preston Washington. I'll be one of your hosts tonight. There will be others joining us. Tonight we are continuing with our series on the book by Benjamin Quarles, Black Abolitionist, and we'll be listening to Chapter 3 tonight. And we would like for you to join in a conversation after we have heard it, and you can call in at area code 347-324-5552. Benjamin Quarles' book is letting us know that black folks spent a great deal of time and effort and energy in their liberation, but it wasn't all up to President Abraham Lincoln. Did I hear somebody just come in there?
Hello?
Hello, caller. Introduce yourself.
Greetings. This is Kwame Shabazz. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. Glad you could join us. And actually, you're our host tonight. What do you, anything you would like to say before we listen to Chapter 3 of Benjamin Quarles' book, The Black Abolitionist? My name is Preston Washington, by the way.
Okay, brother. Nice to meet you. Good to talk to you. Well, let's see. Have we explained the format already?
Not in its entirety. Go right ahead.
Okay, let me just, as I understand it, so we're going to I'll just make a few notes of introduction, and then Sister Leslie, or perhaps you, I'm not sure who, will play the audio, which should last about 30 to 40 minutes, and then we'll come back in and have a dialogue and amongst ourselves, and most importantly, engage with the audience, with callers who call in, and talk up, you know, what we think about the chapter, and maybe more generally about abolitionism or slavery and its relevance to our current predicament. So by way of introduction, I guess I'll just note that for me, or not just for me, for in the way I think about this history and perhaps maybe how it's misconceived, there's an idea that resistance was always about big events and rebellions. And while those were important, and organized events also, so organized abolitionist movements, while those were important, there were also sort of everyday actions that pushed us towards the abolishment of slavery. And there are so many. For example, African people brought African ideas, our ancestors brought ideas with them to the Americas, ideas about family structure, ideas about foods, naming, religion, and all of those ideas, those concepts, those African ideas were used to make sense of this chaos, this horrific condition they found themselves in on plantations. So they used those logics to those African logical systems to maintain a sense of humanity and insist upon their dignity under horrific conditions. So, for example, under let me just take mention a few. One is naming. So, for example, today in 2013, or 2012, we're going to 2013, when we hear the name Leroy, to our ear, or at least to my ear, Leroy sounds like an old-fashioned kind of name. Is that right to you, too?
Sounds that way.
Leroy sounds like an old-fashioned, outdated name.
Mm-hmm.
But Leroy is a French term that means the royal. or the king. And so it was a way that black people insisted on dignity for their children, for their male child. Also with religion, too. So we also, even though at some point after the Great Awakening, Christianity becomes gradually introduced to slaves on plantations, Africans, enslaved Africans, mixed those ideas with their African ideas about God. And so that, too, was a way of resistance. And, of course, they also, they would, although it was illegal, they would learn to read the Bible. And just as the master, the slave master, was using the Bible to oppress them, they were using that same Bible and reading revolution into it. And so for all, in all those ways, those, what I'm saying is that what I'm, the point I'm making is that those two were examples of resistance that don't often get marked as much as rebellions or organized abolitionist movements. And then secondly, I just wanted to point out, as people are listening to the audio, there are some big questions that people might consider. What does it mean to be free? You know, what and indeed, what does it mean to be free in 2012? Is there a different set of meanings for freedom? How was freedom actualized? Who was responsible for the freedom of black people? What exactly did they do? You know, for me, freedom has been about the blood struggle, the blood sacrifice of black people. But oftentimes we think of freedom as sort of enshrined in the lofty words of the founding fathers. But for me, freedom was much more about everyday struggle of black people. And then also, there's a question that doesn't get touched up. It doesn't come into this chapter too much, but it's mentioned. You know, what is the relationship between abolitionism and the freedom of women? How are those two things related or not related? And what does that say about the current relationships between black men and black women and issues of power within those relationships and the role of patriarchy in terms of the ongoing subordination of women generally and black women especially? And then lastly, well, let me know too on freedom. Oftentimes freedom is imagined in certain performative acts. So, for example, we pledge allegiance to the flag, we sing the national anthem, and I, for one, I've never stand up for the national anthem because I don't see myself, I don't hear myself in those words. And so because I don't see our struggle reflected in those words, I don't acknowledge that sort of expression of freedom. So, again, the question is, what do we mean by our freedom, and how was it accomplished? So those are some of the big questions I would have for the audience. So I guess with that, we can go forward with the audio.
Before we do that, I'd like to mention that Ty Gray L. has joined us, and he will be part of the panel tonight. Are you there, Ty?
Yes, sir, I am, Preston, and I'm elated to hear Brother Kwame and what he just expressed, because all of those questions are so relevant. And one of the issues that I have is that a lot of us don't understand the relevance of those questions from the past or what went on in the past and how they are applicable today. But one of the things that resonated with me while you were speaking is that while people were in class during the Pledge of Allegiance, I was being labeled ineducable at the same time that they were pledging allegiance. So I'm trying to figure out, what am I pledging allegiance to when these people have told me that I'm not even able to be educated? So there's a lot in what you say, and I'm just appreciative of this platform.
Yes, yes. Looking forward to the dialogue.
Yes.
Okay, I think we're about ready to hear that tape. Oh, not yet. The engineers have not got it quite keyed up. And I'd just like to say that Dr. Kwame Shabazz, you bring up a very interesting point for me personally that I've been trying to figure out for a minute or two, and that is, what is freedom? What is it indeed? not only in the political sense, but in the psychological sense, etc. What am I free to do? Do I really have free will? Or, then again, if I see something very clearly, then I don't have choice. Is that freedom?
Yeah, and I'll add, too, I teach at an HBCU, a historically black college, university.
What's the name of that HBCU?
Winston-Salem State, North Carolina.
All right.
And for most of my students, it's difficult for them to sort of connect with these past events. For them, you know, they don't see any real impediments to their everyday existence. So they imagine themselves to be that struggle was in the past and it was wholly successful. Not every student thinks that way, but I think a lot of them think that way. It's hard for them to think about. They don't imagine themselves to be. They don't see the barriers that are in place currently in their lives, and so they would say things. You know, and it's pretty typical. I think there are a lot of black people today who would say that, well, you know, if you're in jail, or if the police stopped you, or if you have a police record, it's because you did something wrong, right? Not understanding that this system, the prison justice, the prison industrial complex, the prison system, was put in place specifically to control black people. And it's even in terms of empirical evidence, you know, it's not true that every person who was in prison did a crime, or that every person who was stopped by police officers did something
okay.
wrong.
The engineer advises me that we are ready to queue up.
Okay, great.
Chapter 3, Benjamin Quarles, Black Abolitionists.
Black Abolitionists by Benjamin Quarles, continued. Cassette 2, Side 1.
Good evening, and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Gist of Freedom Estate. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African-American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
Bailey was editor of the Cincinnati Philanthropist, the first anti-slavery journal in the West, whose office had been the target of mobs on 3 occasions. "Your troubles are yet to come, and they may indeed be fiery," wrote Bailey. "The prejudice against the Negro would be directed against his friends," ran Bailey's words of warning. "Their motives would be impeached, their doctrines misrepresented, their good name slandered, and, like as not, their persons assailed." Maria Weston Warren, pillar of the Boston Female Anti-Slavery Society, bore a similar reckoning of the price one paid to join the movement. "It has occasioned our brothers to be dismissed from the pastoral charge, our sons to be expelled from colleges and theological seminaries, our friends from professorships, ourselves from literary and social privileges." By most of their countrymen, the abolitionists were looked upon as sappers of the social order who incited the slaves to rebel and the free Negro to seek intermarriage. And almost as bad, they endangered property rights, enfeebled the church, and subverted the Constitution. Ostracism from polite society was one of the crosses an abolitionist might be called upon to bear. The public health pioneer, Dr. Henry I. Bowditch, found himself debarred from many fashionable parties despite his international reputation in medicine. Ticknor's pleasant literary coteries were no longer accessible, he noted wryly in his journal. For opposing slavery, wrote the clergyman author Theodore Parker, he had got nothing but a bad name. While in Philadelphia in May 1833, the clergyman Samuel J. May escorted one of the Fortin sisters to an abolitionist meeting. When he returned to Boston, he found that the news had preceded him. "Is it true, Mr. May," said a lady to me, "that you walked in the streets of Philadelphia with a colored girl?" To be an abolitionist was to invite economic reprisals, a freezing of one's credit, a loss of employment, or a blacklisting of one's name. A clergyman like Aidan Ballou might have a wealthy parishioner suddenly demand payment on a note. An abolitionist professor might lose his chair, as did Charles Fallon at Harvard, or an abolitionist judge might lose his seat on the bench, as in the case of William Jay, son of the first Chief Justice of the United States. Joshua Coffin lost his mailman's job for assisting a kidnapped Negro. James Russell Lowell was loath to take money for anti-slavery work, but he accepted $500 a year to do a weekly article for the Anti-Slavery Standard, ruefully noting that his abolitionism had cut him off from the most profitable sources of my literary emolument. For his anti-slavery views, John G. Fee was disowned by his father. Social intermingling between whites and blacks in the abolitionist movement had its special perils. A few white abolitionists, troubled because their colored fellow workers faced discrimination in public places, made it a point to appear with them, courting their lot. Still fewer, like Theodore D. Weld, ate at Negro homes and attended their parties, weddings, and funerals. At the marriage of Weld and Angelina Grimke on May 14, 1838, Grace Douglas and Sarah M. Douglas were among the nearly 50 guests, and Theodore S. Wright was one of the two clergymen offering prayers. But such conduct was as unpopular as it was uncommon. When the just-completed Pennsylvania Hall in Philadelphia was sacked and burned 2 days after the Weld-Grimke wedding, the newspapers charged the abolitionists with bringing it about by having Negroes seated side by side with whites at meetings and by condoning, if not fostering, interracial arm-in-arm walking in the streets adjacent to the building. The charge of social intermingling was emotion-laden and hence likely to lead to trouble. In the early days of the movement, abolitionism was synonymous with amalgamationism in the popular mind. Indeed, a white who worked for the repeal of an intermarriage law had as his real object a Negro wife, ran a familiar bit of popular lore. It was unfounded. On one occasion, an unnamed white correspondent to an abolitionist newspaper announced that he was prepared to bear testimony against prejudice by marrying a colored woman who was young, respectable, and intelligent. From Baltimore, the publisher, Hezekiah Niles, acidly remarked that he would like to have the honor of announcing the betrothal. Persons so chivalric should not be thwarted in their desires. But white abolitionists, almost entirely without exception, were not given to marrying across the color line. Even in Massachusetts, after the law repealing the prohibition against it was abrogated in 1843. Denying that they were amalgamationists, the abolitionists charged that racial intermixing was peculiarly a Southern custom, the natural offspring of slavery. "We do not encourage intermarriage between the white and blacks," said the New Hampshire Anti-Slavery Society in a notice to the public. "We would discountenance it expressly and distinctly." Such denials by the reformers had little influence on their detractors, particularly the kind who were prone to taking things in their own hands. Amalgamation was a fuse that could be quickly ignited, all the more because the atmosphere was highly charged. Nonviolence was scarcely an American trait, even in the haunts of Thoreau. As Henry Adams observed in reflecting upon his salad years, "If violence were a part of a complete education, Boston was not incomplete." Whenever he heard Garrison or Phillips speak, he looked for trouble. An abolitionist gathering was hardly a smoothly run affair. At the opening of one of the national meetings at Broadway Tabernacle in New York, a mob took charge for 3 hours, howling till they were hoarse. When the police authorities confessed that they could do nothing, the landlord ordered the abolitionists to leave the building. If property might be endangered, so might persons. Reformers ran the risk of rough handling, although one of them, a professor at Oberlin, wore a specially constructed storm suit while attending abolitionist soirees. Samuel J. May, of quiet manner and fragile build, never forgot an October he spent in Vermont as agent of the New England Anti-Slavery Society. I was mobbed 5 times. In Rutland and Montpelier, my meetings were dispersed with violence. Henry B. Stanton was manhandled 150 times in 6 years, writes the authoritative Dwight L. Dumond, and Theodore D. Weld could be traced from one end of the country to another by such outbursts. Slavery's critics led charmed lives and were seemingly none the worst for their ordeals. In his famous encounter with the Boston mob in the fall of 1835, Garrison sustained certain damages to his clothing, but none in his person. To this seeming immunity from harm, there was one tragic exception, Elijah P. Lovejoy. A clergyman who had become editor of a religious journal, Observer, Lovejoy moved to Alton, Illinois in 1836. Here, as in St. Louis, his anti-slavery views met with determined opposition, his presses being thrown into the river on 3 separate occasions. On a night in November 1837, Lovejoy was shot and killed as he emerged from a building which the mob, bent on destroying his press, had set on fire. Lovejoy's tragedy was given coverage in the public newspapers, and his name became a symbol to reformers. Negroes were especially moved by the Alton affair. The Colored American carried a front-page editorial bordered in black. Boston Negroes held a memorial service at the Smith Street School, and their example was duplicated at Troy, New York, where a saddened company assembled at the Presbyterian Church of Daniel A. Payne. A mass meeting of New York Negroes at the First Colored Presbyterian Church mourned Lovejoy as the first martyr in the holy cause of abolition in the nation. "They held no rights dearer than freedom of speech and of the press," ran one resolution, "rights especially vital in supplementing the dumb eloquence of the downtrodden slave." A collection of $60 was raised for Lovejoy's widow to be sent along with a letter of condolence. A few weeks later, Joseph C. Lovejoy, one of the martyr's brothers, spoke at the same church. Although Lovejoy had not considered himself an abolitionist, the colored people did. His sacrifice strengthened their high regard for crusaders against slavery. In truth, the movement had done much for the Negro. In 1830, a great majority of the 320,000 free Negroes were in the habit of regarding all whites as their enemies. The abolitionists changed this stereotype. Now Negroes could witness the labors and the sacrifices of white men and women in a cause inseparably linked with their own. "The devotion and sacrifices of our white brethren should urge us onward," said the colored American. A figure like Simeon S. Josselyn, zealous abolitionist and white congregational pastor of a Negro church in New Haven from 1830 to 1834, could not fail to impress Negroes. Congratulated by R. R. Gurley of the Colonization Society, Josselyn replied that he felt privileged to be laboring among the colored people. The abolitionist crusade gave to Negroes a heightened sense of self-respect. William Whipper credited it with having a more powerful effect on Negro life than all other influences combined, in checking their evil dispositions and inculcating moral principles. Abolitionism acted as a stimulus to Negroes, like proclaiming life to a valley of dry bones and calling forth energies and powers never before exercised. "I confess that I am wholly indebted to the abolition cause for arousing me from apathy and indifference," wrote Sarah Fortin in April 1837, "shedding light into a mind which had been too long wrapped in selfish darkness." Negroes showed their gratitude by naming their organizations after outstanding figures in the movement. 3 of the benevolent societies in Albany in 1837 were named after Benjamin Lundy, Arthur Tappan, and Garrison, respectively. In the same year, Philadelphia Negroes formed the Levitt Anti-Slavery Society, named after journalist and lecturer Joshua Levitt. In 1840, the National Society split in two, a development that caused the Negro abolitionists to make a fuller use of the resources of the Negro community itself. Their efforts were spurred by a core of new workers, many of them former slaves, who gave a new dimension to the whole movement. Chapter 3. New Tissue for a Broken Body. It is to be regretted that effectual efforts were not made at an early date to furnish a history of the services of men of color. William Yeats, 1838. In the spring of 1840, the abolitionist movement split itself into two camps. One, headed by Garrison, had its nominal headquarters in New York, but was centered in Massachusetts with pockets in Pennsylvania and a lonely outpost or two in Ohio. Drawing its strength from points west of New England, the opposing faction included a score of outstanding figures, among them the Tappans, James G. Birney, Gerrit Smith, Judge William J., Henry B. Stanton, and Joshua Leavitt. Negro abolitionists split also, generally in accordance with the sectional pattern. The schism had its dress rehearsal in Massachusetts, the key issue being the viewpoints of Garrison. By 1839, Garrison had become an unsparing critic of clergymen, charging them with upholding slavery. Negroes supported Garrison in his strictures on the church, but with some misgivings. On one occasion, they stated that Garrison's religious opinions were not necessarily related to the abolitionist movement, and on another, they pointed out that they were Garrison's followers as far as abolition was concerned, but on religious points, we follow Jesus. Garrison's critics justly charged him with espousing reforms that were far afield from abolitionism, such as the non-resistance movement. Considering the existing peace societies unsatisfactory, Garrison was a founder in 1838 of the New England Non-Resistance Society. Garrison scorned the belief that the Bible was of divine inspiration. Moreover, he was an anti-Sabbatarian, holding that no day of the week was holier than any other, and hence regarding as superstition the setting aside of Sunday for religious worship. Garrison was a non-voter. He vowed that he would never hold office or exercise the franchise in a government that included slaveholders. In a public letter to the Negroes of Boston in December 1834, urging them not to support the Whig ticket, Garrison wrote that he saw little intelligence and scarcely any conscience, honesty, or fear of God at the polls. Garrison reasoned that a political party in a country in which slavery existed had to be a pro-slavery party. Moreover, the Constitution, as Garrison saw it, was a pro-slavery instrument and hence not to be supported by a true abolitionist. By 1839, Garrison's critics within the abolitionist ranks felt that a change of leadership was mandatory. At Boston, during the annual meeting of the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society in May, they raised an objection to women voting at the sessions. Many abolitionists believed that the battle for women's rights, however praiseworthy, should not be tied to the cause of the slave, and it was on this key issue that they chose to make their stand at the Massachusetts Society, but to no avail. The ruling of the chair that women should vote was approved by a large majority. The defeated faction withdrew, forming without delay a rival state organization, the Massachusetts Abolition Society. Within a week, the Negro abolitionists held a mass meeting in Boston to consider the schism. Predictably, they did two things: expressed regret at the division in the ranks, and pledged their unanimous support to the Garrison group. For its leader, they had nothing but fulsome praise. They denounced any colored person, if any there be, who was hostile to Garrison, likening such an ingrate to a man who fell off a ship and, when rescued by a Negro, went dripping to the captain to ask if there was no one on board to save him but a nigger. A week later, a mass meeting of Negroes at New Bedford took similar action, affirming that Garrison was right and condemning the Massachusetts Abolition Society. Utter abhorrence of the new organization was the sentiment of a Negro gathering in Salem. From Philadelphia, Grace and Sarah Douglas sent Garrison a supporting letter that was couched in religious and moralistic tones. Negroes in Massachusetts were of a mood to stand by Garrison shoulder to shoulder and foot to foot, as David Ruggles put it. Hence, they were greatly vexed when the Reverend Jehiel C. Beeman took a job with the Massachusetts Abolition Society. With headquarters in Boston, Beeman was to travel to various towns seeking job opportunities for Negroes, and he was to advertise his services in the Colored American and elsewhere. But he got a colder reception in New England than he had anticipated. Garrison and the Boston Negroes, acting in unison, condemned him as a dupe designed to entrap colored people into the new organization. The script for schism was enacted on a wider scale at the annual meeting of the Parent Society in mid-May 1840. Garrison was well prepared for the showdown with the New York abolitionists, even though the site was New York itself. Garrison had made travel arrangements for over 400 followers, hiring boats and extra trains, a step which enabled him to transport his Negro supporters with a minimum of Jim Crow, thus ensuring their attendance. At the meeting, held at the Fourth Free Church, the issue quickly came to a head. Abby Kelly, a staunch Garrisonian, was appointed on the business committee, and the crucial vote was taken as to whether she should be confirmed. The vote of 557 to 451 was in her favor. Thereupon, three members of the business committee withdrew their names on the grounds that to place a woman on the committee was throwing a firebrand into the anti-slavery ranks. 3 days later, the seceding delegates held a meeting at the Fourth Presbyterian Church and brought into existence a new wing, the American and Foreign Anti-Slavery Society. Its roster of founders numbered 294, of which 110 came from New York State, including 62 from New York City itself. Now, after 7 years, no one organization could purport to speak for all abolitiondom. The professed abolitionists were busy abolishing anti-slavery, wrote Abby Kelly, herself the symbol of the split. The results of the rift were immediately reflected in Negro circles, bringing about a similar parting of the ways. The opening scene, fittingly enough, was furnished by Garrison. On May 18th, with the meetings just over, the Negroes of New York held a bon voyage meeting for Garrison, due to embark for London to attend an international anti-slavery conference. The Negroes and some whites packed Theodore S. Wright's First Presbyterian Church. Following Garrison's speech, which was largely his version of the breach in the abolitionist ranks, one of his supporters, Thomas Van Rensselaer, proposed that Garrison and the other delegates chosen by the American Anti-Slavery Society be approved. But there was quick opposition to this resolution, substantially on the ground that it omitted the delegates appointed by the newly organized National Society, one of whom was Samuel E. Cornish. The issue had come to a head. It was, as S.H. Gloucester phrased it, a solemn crisis for the people of color. It was the Negro phase of the battle between old organization versus new organization. The surcharged meeting adjourned by passing no resolution at all, Garrison having made it clear that he would not have his name linked with those from the new organization. Charles B. Ray, a key figure at the meeting, wrote to Birney explaining the somewhat changed attitude of the New York Negro toward the highly revered Bostonian. If the colored people of this city or any section of this country do manifest less warmth of feeling than formerly toward Mr. Garrison, it is in part owing to our friends having multiplied, and as a necessary consequence, our good feeling is scattered upon all instead of being concentrated upon one as when Mr. Garrison stood alone. Many Negro abolitionists had indeed turned their faces toward the new sun. 8 of them attended the meetings which launched the American and Foreign Anti-Slavery Society, 3 of whom were named to the 12-man executive committee. Amos G. Beeman served as assistant secretary at the convention, and the closing prayer at the final session was given by Theodore S. Wright. The great majority of black abolitionists in New England would not be drawn into the new society, regarding it as schismatic. Boston Negroes held a meeting to pledge anew their fealty to the old organization, and Negroes at a gathering in New Bedford saw fit to give a tortured explanation to the word foreign in the title of the new society, charging that its tenets were foreign to the principles of freedom and equality. The old organization did not look kindly upon defectors, white or black. Neutrals fared little better, as John W. Lewis soon learned. Having assumed his duties on February 1, 1839, Lewis was an agent for the New Hampshire Anti-Slavery Society. In his first 10 months, Lewis had raised $565, and the society was pleased with his work. "Nobody thinks of colored inferiority when they hear Brother Lewis," said the Herald of Freedom, organ of the society. When the parent organization split, Lewis declared his neutrality. Thereupon, he quickly lost favor with the New Hampshire Society, an old organization affiliate. Its executive board charged that Lewis drew large crowds solely because he was a Negro and not because of his public speaking, which was long and loud to the point of exhaustion. The board members expressed the hope that Brother Lewis would take himself to places where he could get more attention and better pay. Lewis fired back with a lengthy reply, in essence expressing the hope that the New Hampshire Society would reserve its heavy guns for slavery instead of disgusting its members by exhibiting a harsh spirit of contention. The Lewis episode and the whole split in the abolitionist ranks tended to make Negroes more outspoken toward their fellow crusaders. The Negroes' considerable indebtedness to the white reformers had never blinded him to their shortcomings. Now, with so much linen being washed in public, the Negro had his bundle to bring, a mixed bundle and of no mean proportions. To begin with, many white co-workers were charged with harboring race bias. "Abolitionists have overlooked the giant sin of prejudice," said Theodore S. Wright in an address at Utica before the New York Society, "and thus must rid their own bosoms of this foul monster, which is at once the parent and offspring of slavery." Speaking before the Albany Anti-Slavery Society in February 1838, Nathaniel Paul described the kind of abolitionist who hated slavery, especially that which is 1,000 or 1,500 miles off, but who hated even more a man who wears a colored skin. 6 weeks after the split, Samuel Ringgold Ward wrote a letter to the Anti-Slavery Standard describing abolitionists who best love the colored man at a distance. In social circles or in company with other whites, this ilk found it difficult to see Negroes, even though they had spectacles on their noses. In July 1849, when James Russell Lowell proposed the name of Frederick Douglass for membership in the short-lived, intellectually-oriented Town and Country Club, he was astonished at encountering opposition, with the finger of suspicion pointing strongly at the high-principled Ralph Waldo Emerson. "One of the reasons so many whites joined the abolitionist movement," wrote a Negro editor, "was their belief that it stood for abstract principles to be applied to the South without requiring them to battle the prejudices in their own hearts." James McCune Smith found it strange that in the Constitution of the American Anti-Slavery Society, no mention was made of social equality as one of its aims. The editor of the Northern Star and Freeman's Advocate had a terse bit of advice. "Until abolitionists eradicate prejudice from their own hearts, they can never receive the unwavering confidence of the people of color." There were instances in which white abolitionists attended concerts or recitals at which Negroes were barred or segregated. Moreover, some abolitionists, particularly during the formative 1830s, held that Negroes should not be admitted to anti-slavery meetings or hold membership in the societies, a topic which Charles Fallon aired fully at the meeting of the Massachusetts Society in January 1836. A year earlier, a few colored young women began to attend the monthly gatherings of the Fall River Female Anti-Slavery Society, a circumstance that almost brought about its dissolution. At its meeting on September 15, 1837, the Junior Anti-Slavery Society of the City and County of Philadelphia debated the question, "Is it expedient for colored persons to join our anti-slavery societies?" The vote of 31 in favor to 21 against was hardly reassuring to Negroes in light of the youthful and presumably more liberal makeup of the society. Negroes in Albany were disenchanted with a local abolitionist who refused to rent them a frame tenement, giving as his reason the attitude of his neighbors. This consideration for the feelings of the community was the chief argument advanced by the conservative abolitionists. Undoubtedly, however, it often cloaked a color prejudice of which the practitioner was not aware. In reformist circles, as elsewhere, there was a strong undercurrent of anti-Negro sentiment, mirrored in the common preference for light-skinned Negroes over those of richer pigmentation. "She was not very dark," wrote Sarah H. Southwick of Susan Paul, a fellow member of the Boston Female Anti-Slavery Society. Joshua Easton might urge his white co-workers to strike not at slavery alone, but against the spirit which made color the mark of degradation. However, there were limits to what exhortation would do. Conquering an aversion to social contacts with Negroes was not easy. Abolitionizing one's own heart was a formidable assignment. Even when they worked side by side, white and Negro abolitionists scarcely sustained a peer relationship. Whites tended to be paternalistic, reflecting a father-knows-best attitude. They tended to praise an above-average Negro almost to the point of eulogy, as if in surprise that he revealed any ability at all. And, like the earlier abolitionists, they were fond of giving advice to Negroes, their remarks interlarded with beatitudes. The advice might have been good. Certainly it was much like that given by Negro leaders themselves. But if one Negro criticized another for patronizing a Dan Rice minstrel show while ignoring a magic lantern exhibition on slavery being held in the same block, the whole thing somehow seemed freer of racial connotations. The chief criticism against the white abolitionists by their black counterparts was their half-heartedness in carrying out the second of their twin goals, the elevation of the free Negro. Equal rights for Negroes was an essential corollary of abolitionism. Improving the lot of the Northerners of color was a clearly stated goal. The Maine Union in behalf of the colored race, formed in Portland in 1835, was a reflection of this outlook. Aware of this dual commitment, nearly every abolitionist society had a special committee on the welfare of the free Negro. But in most instances, this is about as far as it went. Such committees, as a rule, simply did not function. Hence, in this quarter, the abolitionists were vulnerable. In their strong campaign against slavery in the South, they half overlooked slavery in the North, wrote a Negro editor in 1839. The Negro people needed jobs, as their spokesman constantly stressed. In 1831, Maria W. Stewart asked several women to hire colored girls. Abolitionists were asked to give Negro apprentices and mechanics an equal chance at least, and a preference if possible, there being neglected people. In an editorial that brought a flood of approving letters, an Albany Weekly informed the white abolitionists that Negroes did not expect to ride in their carriages or sup at their parties, but they did hope that avenues of employment would be opened up by their alleged friends. Such thrusts, sharp as they were, brought few changes. Most white abolitionists simply did not think in terms of the working man, white or colored. Men of great understanding in some things, they never seemed to fully sense that economic freedom was co-equal with, if not basic to, all other freedoms. To be sure, there were a few gestures by individuals and organizations. In isolated instances, an abolitionist might employ a skilled Negro. Louis Tappan, for example, paid Patrick H. Reason $70 to do a steel engraving of his brother, Benjamin. The Tappans were pleased with the product, and Lewis thought that the anti-slavery cause would be advanced if it were known that a Negro was capable of such craftsmanship. But, he added in his letter to Reason, "perhaps it will be best to wait until you have engraved two or three more before the secret is let out." Abolitionist organizations made some token efforts to help the black working man. Following an address by Charles Lennox Remond in November 1837, the Rhode Island Anti-Slavery Society voted to aid Negroes to get jobs as clerks. The Philanthropist, organ of the Ohio Society, made its office into a referral agency at which employers willing to take colored apprentices might leave their names, and colored parents with sons to be apprenticed might follow suit. Perhaps the most futile attempt at helping the Negro by an organization was furnished by the American Union for the Relief and Improvement of the Colored Race. Founded in Boston in 1835 and backed by 100 men in 10 states, it proposed to give elementary schooling to the Negro and to teach him trades. The American Union's membership was of the old-school pillars of society type, men who were given more to reflection than to action. Hoping to resurrect the harmony and forbearance of the old days, they shied away from the word immediate, favored colonization, and preferred to characterize slavery as a wrong rather than as a sin, a vital distinction then. As could be expected, the Union aroused the scorn and hostility of Garrison. Labeling it an anti-Garrison society, he issued an address to Negroes informing them that the object of the Union was to put them down, with him thrown in for good measure. This ended the possibility that the Union would obtain the necessary cooperation of the colored people in the 1830s. The Union expired within 2 years. Even under happier auspices, an organized effort to assist the free Negro might not have met with success. In 1836, the American Anti-Slavery Society appointed 4 agents to work among Negroes devising ways to improve their lot. The suggestion had come from Theodore Weld, whose courage, devotion, and success in winning others to the cause had already marked him in reform circles. In February 1836, Weld wrote to Lewis Tappan, listing 10 reasons why the parent society should turn its attention to the elevation of the free Negro. Tappan agreed fully with Weld's memorandum, rewording it in a handwritten report to his fellow members on the executive committee. The committee decided to appoint 4 agents, selecting Hiram Wilson for the Canadian Theater, John J. Mitre and William Yates for work in the East, and Augustus Wattles for Ohio. Wattles, a particular protege of Weld, was designated as Generalissimo of the colored people. A thoroughgoing egalitarian, he had lodged with a colored family while in Cincinnati as a student at Lane Seminary. The agents were dedicated men, but this was not enough. Nor did the project fail for lack of cooperation from Negroes. 8 colored clergymen in New York issued a circular urging full support of the agents and addressed not only to New Yorkers, but also to the free colored citizens of the United States and to all their Christian brethren and friends. But the enthusiasm of the Negroes and the high spirits of the agents could not offset a lack of funds. The parent society, in the panic year of 1837, was unable to finance the agents, withdrawing all support by the summer of 1838. The effort was not wholly lost. Hiram Wilson was launched on a career among Canadian Negroes that became his life's work. Yates made a careful survey of Delaware, slavery and the colored people in Delaware, which he found depressing. "The Negroes there were undervalued," he wrote, "their virtues being disregarded and their degradation magnified." Yates also produced a 104-page pamphlet on civil rights, interspersing it with snatches of Negro history. "The subject is a rich one," he concluded. Yates also produced a survey of the Negroes on Long Island. John J. Mitre, apparently the least active of the agents, brought out a study of the Negroes in Newark. Wattles was a zealous worker. In the 3 months of the spring of 1837, he traveled 575 miles in Ohio, visiting 14 Negro settlements and 44 schools. Late in 1837, he extended his operations into Indiana. Wattles remained on the field for 7 years longer, but his funds came from friends and from his own inheritance, the parent society having withdrawn its support. "We are grieved at the discontinuance of the labors of Messrs. Wattles, Yates, and Wilson," wrote the Colored American on October 27, 1838. If elevating the free Negro required money, it also called for common sense. And this, too, was something missing in the proposals made by the abolitionists. In 1839, the New York City Anti-Slavery Society, in a 13-point list of ways to help the colored people, recommended that a book on domestic economy be printed for them and that a joint stock company be organized to trade with the West Indies. Many white abolitionists, as Negroes had sorrowfully come to learn by 1840, had a tendency to abstraction. Such white co-workers viewed the movement as an ideological warfare, the outcome of which was secondary to the stimulus of the mental jousting. To strike a moral posture was more important than to strike at slavery. Wendell Phillips, although almost without peer in the Crusade, voiced something of this sense of disengagement in an informal talk to a gathering of fellow reformers at Cochituate Hall in Boston. "My friends, if we never free a slave, we have at least freed ourselves in the effort to emancipate our brother man." Negro abolitionists, with the exception of William Whipper, had no fondness for abstraction. Their interest was more personal. A Negro could scarcely muster enough detachment to live in the realms of pure principle, the world being too much with him. An abolitionist who could say, as did Charles K. Whipple, that the principles of morality and religion remain undisturbed by our private exigency was likely to be white, that is, a person with a less urgent private exigency. In their ranks, the abolitionists had some question marks. Like any other reform, the Crusade had its component of deviant personalities who found in it a release for private devils. The movement also had its universal reformers, men who, like Garrison, embraced several causes concurrently, thus diluting their abolitionism. And finally, the movement had its summer soldiers, who, after a season, disappeared in the shadows. Impulses to withdraw from the movement were numerous, ranging from a waning sympathy for the slave to a desire to concentrate on making enough money to put one's sons through college. All of these sobering factors became more evident to the Negro when the abolitionists split in 1840. Negroes realized that a more realistic appraisal of the movement was in order. The Negro would have to look more to his own strength to put into fuller anti-slavery use his own organizations. Fortunately for the Negroes, they were no strangers to acting in national concert. They had been holding national conventions since mid-September 1830, when 40 delegates from 8 states met at Bethel Church in Philadelphia with Richard Allen in the chair. For the following 5 years, the Negro leaders held national conventions, generally in Philadelphia. These meetings addressed themselves to three topics, or perhaps three aspects of the same topic. Namely, the repeal of the black laws of the various northern states, the advancement of the free Negro, and the wiping out of slavery. After 1835, the national conventions were held intermittently rather than annually. Their place was filled in some measure by state conventions, such as that held by New York Negroes from 1836 to 1850. Already fervently anti-slavery, the black convention movement would take on an even stronger abolitionist character with the 1840 split in the parent society. The division in the American Anti-Slavery Society has generally been held to be a weakening of the movement. So it was, if one counts the decrease in the number of auxiliaries and the decline in membership. But the split actually had beneficial effects, taking abolitionism into new channels of expression, thus broadening its base. The division in the National Society spewed a variety of isms, resulting in moral suasion abolitionism and political abolitionism, wrote William Goodell, a highly respected figure in the Crusade. Then came also church reform abolitionism, missionary abolitionism, Methodist, Baptist, Congregational, Independent, and Presbyterian abolitionism. Politicians were careful to supply a Whig and a Democratic abolitionism. and Goodell might have added, there was a Negro abolitionism. Following the national division in 1840, the immediate question facing the Negro leaders was whether to adopt a go-it-alone policy, relying exclusively on all Negro agencies. The issue came to the fore in May 1840, when a group of Connecticut Negroes meeting in Hartford recommended that a national convention of black men be held in New Haven in September. Such a meeting was necessary because of the division among our friends, as the Reverend J. W.C. Pennington phrased it. Another delegate, James Foster, concurred fully, pointing out that to talk about waiting till our friends get right is nonsense. We must act for ourselves. But this call met with a cool response from the influential leaders of the American Moral Reform Society, an organization that had been created by the Black Convention of 1835. Meeting in August 1840, the moral reformists condemned the proposed convention on the grounds that it drew the color line. A week later, William Whipper and Robert Purvis, two of the society's leaders, sent word to David Ruggles, organizer of the scheduled convention, that they could not attend any gathering that was exclusive in character. To those who favored the proposed Negro convention, it was a means of self-expression. If we act with our white friends, wrote Charles B. Ray, the words we utter will be considered theirs, or their echo. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.
Unmuted. Are you there, Dr. Sabat?
Yes, I'm here. Hold on one sec. Let's see. Okay, yes, I'm here.
Okay, what are your first impressions on that tape?
Well, let's see. First, I'd be remiss if I didn't send out happy Kwanzaa greetings to our brothers and sisters. Today is Kuji Chagulia, the second day of Kwanzaa, self-determination. So happy Kwanzaa to all those who celebrate it, and also Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to the listeners. Just a few things sort of giving, I guess, some context. I wanted to note that, of course, this section covers the 1830s, and really a really important event happened around this time, and that was David Walker's on the scene. Now, David Walker is an African-American abolitionist, and I call him the father of black nationalism. And, you know, he's based in Boston, just as, you know, Boston, the New England area, was an important site for abolitionist struggle, as was mentioned in the audio. So David Walker, obviously.
Excuse me, Dr. Bass. Yeah, are you on a speakerphone?
No, I'm not. Is there some feedback?
There's a little bit of feedback on it, yes.
Okay, yeah, I'm not sure what that is.
Okay.
So Walker writes a book, publishes a book in 1829 called David Walker's Appeal, and it's a polemical tract against slavery, and he's basically encouraging black people to rise up and violently overthrow their oppressors. And he's also saying that he's also criticizing white Christians. He's saying that how can you be a Christian and enslave your fellow brothers and sisters? You're hypocrites. And because they're hypocrites, that gives black people the right to overthrow these hypocritical people who have enslaved them. So David Walker is on the scene. He publishes his book in 1829. The book is deemed seditious in the South and outlawed in some parts of the South. And there's a bounty put over his head, dead or alive bounty. And then Walker dies mysteriously in Boston in 1831. And then something really extraordinary happens. Mariah Stewart, who was also, she actually lived in the same compound as David Walker in Boston. And if you ever go to Boston, you should be sure to check out the site has a commemorative plaque there that commemorates, you know, this is where David Walker lived. So Mariah Stewart, an African-American woman, takes up David Walker's movement, which is really extraordinary for that time because women basically didn't have access to, well, patriarchy was extreme, and so women, black or white, did not have the same rights as men. And so Mariah Stewart is making public speeches in front of male and female audiences, which was unheard of at that time. But she doesn't last long, maybe about 7 years, because black and white men have a difficult time accepting the idea of a radical black woman being at the forefront of the abolitionist movement. So I just wanted to mention that as an important sort of backdrop. So I think it maybe it's interesting that white abolitionism becomes a national movement in 1830s after David Walker dies.
So Dr. Shabazz, you said that he died mysteriously.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, poison. I mean, is there any? I mean, is this just shrouded in mystery, or is there any? Has there been any pointed anything pointed in the way he died?
It's all speculative. He was found dead, and the causes of his death are still unclear.
Yeah.
Yeah. At that time, you know, they didn't always keep very good records, so we just don't know for certain how he died.
Well, you know, I think I found it interesting. I mean that period was so volatile in the first place. I mean, when the piece first started off, they were talking about judges losing their bench appointments, postmen losing their jobs, focusing on their parents. So I'm sure people turned up dead. I'm sure dogs were murdered, horses killed. I mean, just about anything that you could possibly think of to dissuade, us, you know, progressing in any manner.
Absolutely.
So him being, I'm not shocked that he would turned up mysteriously dead.
That's right. One of the big points of this chapter is that standing up and saying I am in favor of ending slavery was a dangerous act, regardless of what color you were. And so these were very turbulent times for black struggle and also for our white allies who fought alongside
us. To make that point, one of the things I remember, I remember him saying that there was a white abolitionist by the name of Elijah P. Lovejoy who was a printer. And they destroyed his presses and murdered him for just speaking out on, you know, being an advocate for anti-slavery.
Right, and that's why I haven't read the whole book, so I don't know how it plays out, but that's why I was mentioning David Walker, because Elijah P. Lovejoy, according to the author, is lifted up as sort of the martyr of the abolitionist movement. And I would say, why wouldn't it be David Walker? But I guess part of it is that, you know, Lovejoy is part of perhaps because he's part of a national movement.
I would also add, Dr. Shabazz, with respect to that, the ancient African proverb which states that until the lion is able to tell his story, the hunter will always get the glory.
That's right. Very true.
And so they always raise up and martyr, you know. I mean, it's very interesting. We really have to be proactive and progressive with respect to taking back our own history and understanding how much power we had, and take some of the power away from those who were against us in the first place. David Walker, like you said, and I agree. I mean, this guy was, you know, he pushed the envelope the way it should have been pushed, in the same manner that these United States pushed the envelope against England when it was fighting for its freedom. It's the same thing that David Walker was doing with respect to us. No,
that's
difference.
Right. Yeah, that's true. And you know, of course, we're leading up to the Civil War. We're just 30 to 40 years away from the Civil War. So.
Yeah.
inevitably we're going in that direction. And, you know, how the Civil War plays out has everything to do with, you know, well, has a lot to do with these internal struggles within the abolitionist movement.
So I'd like to jump in here a moment.
Yes,
and let our readers, our listeners know that David Walker is also discussed in Chapter 2. And
okay.
In Chapter 2 of the book, Black Abolitionist. And what do you gentlemen think that the whites, you mentioned the gentleman whose printing press was thrown in the river and he was murdered, and David Walker, who, by the way, was a Malcolm X of his day.
That's right.
And but why were some of these white folks willing to take the risks so much that they undertook, putting their life and limb on the line? Any thoughts on that?
I think I agree with the author who says that, you know, the aims of whites and the aims of blacks weren't exactly the same, right? So white abolitionists, who were typically men and they typically were elite men, their idea was sort of more a moralizing, abstract idea of freedom. In other words, and also they mentioned that you know, this was a movement that was based in the North, and so it was something they were targeting. The enemy was those people in the South, the backwards people down in the South. It's not us who is the we're not part of the problem. We're a part of the solution. As long as they could imagine that they weren't a part of the problem, and that they imagined themselves doing something noble. Doing something noble in lines with, you know, the vaunted American principles of freedom, justice, and equality, it made sense to them.
Yeah, on several levels.
As the chapter notes, you know, and this is difficult for people to understand. It's difficult for my students to get all the time. Is that you could have two sort of conflicting ideas in your head. On the one hand, you could be a white man, an abolitionist, and be anti-slavery, but you could also be anti-black and not believe that blacks and whites should have social equality.
Well, that was a great deal of motivation for whites to turn out to support Anthony Burns, who was an escaped slave from Virginia. And so what do you think the motivation there was? I mean, you know, Boston had a history at that time of supporting runaway slaves and protecting them. In fact, eventually, it was a black church that put together about $1,300 that finally freed Anthony Suttles, or Anthony Burns, after he had been returned to his slave owner, Charles Suttle in Virginia.
Well, I totally agree on several levels with Dr. Shabazz. You know, it was a means of absolving themselves and holding themselves out as, you know, a little bit better. We're upper class. Our blood is a little bluer. But also, you have to bear in mind that there were some genuine humanitarians among them. Who genuinely wanted to see slavery abolished. And then you have to take into account the body politic and all of those things. There's so many ramifications. But I'm thinking that, and it was a mixture of all of those things that would cause, you know, white folk, their Bible and their Constitution said that this was wrong. You're not supposed to be enslaving any kind of human being with whatever color they may be.
Now, of course, you can use the Bible to justify all sorts of things. You know, the Ku Klux Klan members were Christians, right? And so they read the Bible in a certain way that could justify white supremacy. You have Joseph Kony in Uganda who wants to, you know, his reading of the Bible says that Uganda should be governed by the Old Testament. Right, so the Bible can be used to justify all sorts of atrocities too. And so that's the thing, too. It's a book, and so people have to interpret it. And that's why I mentioned in my opening that African-Americans, whereas whites often use the Bible as a tool of oppression, blacks would look at the condition of the Jews. You know, the Jews were enslaved just like we are. And God chose the Jews, so God will choose us against our oppressors. And so they were able to see the Jewish story as a corollary to their story. And in that way, they could read revolution into the Bible, use the Bible as a tool of resistance, just as the oppressors were using as a tool of domination.
I think that's an interesting point on the Bible and religion being used to support or not support slavery. And John G. Fee was mentioned in the piece, who had a very public and deep falling out with Cassius Clay. Both of them gentlemen were Kentuckians, but they disagreed on the higher power or the religious aspect and became bitter enemies. I think that's a very good point made about that Bible. Another thing that struck me as we were talking about Christians and particular religions, it seems that the Presbyterians and the Methodists were heavily involved. Unitarian Universalist, Ralph Waldo Emerson was mentioned, and he was a Unitarian. And I noticed an absence, or at least thus far, of Catholics and Baptists and some of the mainstream Christians not being spoke of. You gentlemen have any ideas on that?
Well, before we go there, I was just thinking about how, and to get back to your point right away, but to make this point, is that William Lloyd Garrison, he came out vehemently against anybody using the Bible. He scolded the pastors for upholding slavery using those same stories that you just mentioned, Dr. Shabbat.
That's right.
So I think it's interesting that there were some who realized that using the Bible was, you know, just a mental garrote around the necks of those folk who were trying to free themselves. Now, with respect to your question about the Catholics and the Baptists and those mainstream religious sects, I never thought about that. That's an interesting question.
Well, I wanted to note, too, with Garrison, it sort of cuts both ways. But on the other, so Garrison sort of points to I think a legitimate critique of how the Bible and Christian leaders can also participated in perpetuating slavery. But on the other hand, I think his position, it was clear that his position weakened his alliance with African Americans, because African Americans have consistently they've relied on spirituality and religion as a means towards maintaining their sanity, really, under really horrific conditions. And so, for them, they could not go with Garrison when he critiques Christianity as sort of an impediment to freedom, because they see religion as a necessary component or element of their freedom. And so, in that sense, Garrison's position, I think, compromises his relationship with African Americans. And that takes us, up to the 1940 split. You know, so you have, at this time, you have a splintering of within the white abolitionist movement. And that then goes ahead and opens up the movement for African Americans to be more assertive about their position about their demand.
So
and then they're also about,
let me ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask
you
a question, Doc. So what is it that you teach specifically down at Winston-Salem?
African-American studies. So I teach an intro class, and then I teach a class called World African Cultures.
Okay.
And then I teach a class called Negritude and Afrocentricity.
Okay, yeah. Well, I ask you that because it's interesting. Leslie Gist is of course, in the chat room with a few others, and she pointed out just now that that the author, Mr. Quarles, pointed out that they used language subtly to manipulate, and I just wanted your professorship around that, how they would refer to slavery as wrong rather than slavery as sin.
Right.
And the ramifications of that, especially with respect to us being as religious and spiritual as we were, a big difference between something being wrong and something being sinful.
That's why it pointed to the fact that whites and blacks, they were together in this resistance movement, but whites weren't willing to go. White abolitionists weren't willing to go the entire way with African Americans towards their vision of freedom. Well, there was a limit to where elite white men would go with this movement, and that language spoke to their limitations.
Yeah.
So with this 1940 split, I think it's really important in that. Besides the fact that the white movement is splitting up, African Americans are now critiquing white abolitionists, and they're two biggest critiques in this chapter. Number one, their white comrades are paternalistic. You know, in so long as whites are leading the struggle, then it makes sense to them. But treating blacks as equal partners becomes problematic for white members of the movement.
Yeah, I mean, think about it.
And then the other, yeah, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
No, to your point, black folk weren't even allowed to attend abolitionist meetings. I mean, that's incredulous to me. There was a point in the chapter when I remember my eyebrows kind of furrowed when I heard that blacks weren't even allowed to attend the meetings in which they were supposed to be, where they were the central point.
That's right.
It's amazing.
Yeah, there was it's a huge irony.
Was 37 to 21 against admitting them? Or was it the other way around?
No, that's right, 37 to 21. At one particular convention, I forget which one it was, but they came out 37-21 against allowing. To me, that's just unconscionable, man.
That was probably the motivation for the blacks to start their own conventions, national conventions, like the first one being at Bethel Church in Pennsylvania.
Now, I think the other question, too, that I would have, a really important question is, this happened 180 years ago. So we're going into 2013. And, the big question in my head is, that I imagine, a lot of young folk would have, especially, what in the world does that have to do with us now? Is it relevant for us? And what I have my students do sometimes, I'll have them, and maybe you guys can tell me what you think. If you were going to rank relative power in the U.S., so taking white men, white women, black men, black women, how would you rank them in terms of power? One being the highest power, or having the most power. One through four. So how would you rank them? One through four. One having the most power. Four having the least power.
Immediately. I'm saying, and it's in gradations. And when I say gradations, I'm talking about with respect to skin color. Mm-hmm. White being the most power, and then the lighter skin being two, the less lighter.
No lighter skin, just four categories. White men, white women, black men, black women, just to keep it simple.
Oh, okay. All right, well, 1, 2, 3, 4, you got it right there.
Yeah, how would you rank them?
I would put white men, black women, white women, black men.
So black women have more power than white women?
in some respects,
interesting.
I'm going over now. You got to consider my age, but I can remember a time, and particularly my grandfather who lived in the South. And when you think about the history, black women could always deal with the white man better than black men would or could. Black men would send their women in to deal with the white man in terms of banking, buying land, selling land, anything to do with business. And I'm talking about the lower echelon. I'm talking about the farmers, the pagans, the peon class of people. White, black
interesting.
Share that
okay.
business.
Yeah.
Okay.
So from let's say from the 1830s forward, you're saying that black women have more power than white women. Well, let me get to my point then, because we're almost out of time. Here's how I rank them, or here's what I tell my students, that it's clear that black men are at the top, white men are at the top. That part is clear, that they have the most power. And then for me, to my thinking, white women are below white men because they are partners. Right, so they form marital bonds. They have families, and it's clear from 1830s or even 1619 to the 1830s up to the 1950s, white women had rights that black people did not have.
Right,
and so to my sense, in my way, it's pretty clear that white women are second on the scale. Now, the tricky part here is that where do you put black men and black women in terms of relative power?
Well, immediately when you posed the question, I thought 1, 2, 3, 4. White men,
okay.
1. Second, white women. 3, black women. 4, black men.
Yes, okay.
And the reason why I say that is because having... growing up in the nation's capital, born and raised in Washington, D.C., I noticed that there are so many governmental positions that black women hold, and these black women are in positions of power over the black men, literally. I'm not talking figuratively. I'm talking about literally. And they are right second nature to white women. So that's how I see it. And of course I could probably write 3 or 4 papers on the subject, but
this question doesn't have a right or wrong. It's just to get people to think about power. Now my take is that the black women and black male categories are situational, so it depends on what you're looking at. For example, if you look at the period of the right after Reconstruction, black men were oftentimes a target of lynchings. So if we're thinking about lynchings and sort of brute violence targeting black people, perhaps black men were below black women. But it's also true that black women were also subject to rape. Rape was a huge problem. White men raping black women was also a huge problem that, you know, obviously black men did not have to contend with as often. So in that sense, black women were disadvantaged. But it's also true that, you know, in terms of patriarchy, black, if you look at the 1830s period that we discussed in this chapter, black women were pretty much invisible. It was black men who were in the forefront in the political arena struggling for abolitionism, because black women were not allowed to be in that space. They were blocked by not only white people but also black men. So in that sense,
in the piece, wasn't there a mention of the black women who made contributions to the movement?
They made contributions to the movement, but they were marginalized.
Yeah, there was
it's not that they weren't as intelligent, or not that they were equally adamant about ending slavery, but they were being blocked because of patriarchy. And so this is a part I think that black men often miss, is that even in the midst of struggle, you know, from 1830s or even 1700s up until 2013, patriarchy too has played an important role in. So even as black men are struggling against oppression by white people, we also have a relationship with black women that we should look at and interrogate more closely, and see in what ways are we limiting our struggle by subordinating black women.
Yeah, and the point that you're raising is so salient to this whole conversation, and that is that we're talking about this patriarchal system, and, you know, we're talking about, well, as I remember the man laws now, and I'm revealing my age a little bit, but I remember the man laws of the 50s where I saw this subtle change, and where black women started to get more power. The man laws, you know, made it so that if the government would come along, if a man was in the house, a black man was in the house,
mm-hmm.
then the black woman wasn't able to get her welfare check. And,
That's right.
And you saw the rise of the importance and the matriarchal hierarchy, I guess, in the black community over the patriarchal, which had previously been patriarchal. So I'm feeling what you're saying, and again, you know, it's so much to be explored here, man. Just a lot.
Right. Now, and the other thing too to remember about in terms of that specific chapter is that women's rights was specifically a wedge issue in terms of, you know, the abolitionist movement.
A what issue?
A wedge issue. So that they were debating women's rights within the abolitionist movement. But the contention was that if you bring on women's rights, it dilutes the struggle for ending slavery.
Women's rights were subordinated to the abolitionist movement.
That's why they wound up being subordinated during that period. And what I'm saying, my bottom line is that question of the role of women, white women, black women, black men, white men, that still is a question that we haven't really dealt with. There still needs to be lots of conversation around it. We haven't adequately, especially black people, I think, black men and black women to talk about this issue.
In terms of black women, I mean, we learned in the last chapter, the previous chapter, that black women were very involved from a financial standpoint.
Yes.
Knitting, sewing, selling. One lady was mentioned selling apples on the street and sending 50% of her proceeds to the movement.
Yeah.
Right.
Something else we need to throw in here, our engineer is pointing out that Frederick Douglass fought with the women's suffrage movement.
Absolutely.
And so we, you know, that it really was a central issue that wasn't in that it was in there, it was involved, but it wasn't on the front burner, because if you put that on the front burner, it appeared to dilute what the abolitionists were actually trying to accomplish. And, you know, it's similar, and I know I'm treading on dangerous ground even bringing this point up, but it just brings to mind the same thing with respect to gay rights movement as opposed civil rights movement.
It's a good point.
In this day and time. And so, it's interesting. It's interesting.
Yeah, so the just as women's rights was a wedge issue in the 1830s, nowadays gay rights is a wedge issue for African Americans. You know, the NAACP, which is, you know, used to be our premier, I guess it still is, our premier institution for civil rights for black people, the NAACP has now an official position that gay rights is a part of the civil rights struggle. But on the ground, that's debatable. You know, the African Americans don't agree. There's disagreement over this issue of whether or not there's contention over whether or not whether or not we're going to accept it or not. So not everyone agrees that gay rights should be a component of or a part of. In fact, some resent it. And so that you're right. It's a good parallel that today the wedge issue is, one of the wedge issues is gay rights.
Yeah.
Are there any historic sites out there that our listeners can visit? I think you mentioned one earlier, Dr. Shabazz, David Walker's home. What about David Walker's home, the Bethel Church there in Philadelphia?
I don't know Philadelphia at all, but yeah, I you know, when I was in Boston for a number of years, and so Boston has a tour of, you know, important sites, sites that were important for Black struggle in the Boston area, and you can take that tour. And also Malcolm X, of course, was in, spent some formative years in Boston. So the house that he lived in, Ella Collins, his half-sister's house, is still there. It's owned by his, Malcolm X's nephew, Rodnell Collins, and you know, the house is still there. People can go and visit, see the house today.
Yeah, I know that here in, well, I'm right on the outskirts of the District of Columbia, right in, you know, right equidistance between Baltimore and Washington, D.C., and I know that there are several sites beginning on the eastern shore of Maryland that go all the way through Maryland into Pennsylvania, through Jersey, even up to New York, through Ohio, and there's, you know, there's an actual trail that you can go on if you went online and put Underground Railroad in there. I would ask the listeners to get a book, man, that changed my life. It's a book entitled Bullwhip Days. Bullwhip Days is a book of actual slave narratives that were in the 1930s. Some folk got together and interviewed people born in the 1800s, you know, people that lived through Jim Crow, actually lived through slavery. Some folk in the 1930s who were actually still enslaved in Alabama, Georgia, Florida,
yes,
places like that. And, man, mm-hmm. some of the dialogue is just so incredible as to, because they, you know, they say it straight up the way it was, even in that vernacular. So that's a book I would suggest listeners get.
I would also
Go ahead, Doc. I'm also
recommend that the First Presbyterian Church there in Harlem, founded by Samuel Quanisch and Theodore Wright, would be a place to visit if you're in the New York area.
Mm-hmm.
They were also the founders of the first black newspaper in the early 1700s.
David Ruggles up in New York.
David Ruggles in New York? Okay.
Yeah, in Harlem, man. He was, man, I'm finding out. If you haven't done anything on David Ruggles, Leslie Gist, I'd heard his name before, but I wasn't really, you know, apprised of what this guy's work. This guy,
yeah, he's
David Ruggles, he was an instrument, man. He was like a David Walker in New York. He was like a David Walker up in Boston. He was the same guy, you know, in New York City. So I would ask you to, you know, look up his stuff. And I was told by somebody in the chat room on my side that I have to do a shameless plug before we get off the air, and that is to go to tigrayl.com. I have a lot of information out there with respect to, you know, what I'm, you know, with the breath of my ancestors and the same work that we are purporting here. So I just wanted, you know, I'm the worst at
excellent
at plugging myself, but I had to do.
Yeah, I'll also mention David Walker's Appeal. If I were going to recommend the book, you can download it for free online. So just Google David Walker's Appeal, and you can read the entire book or download it from the internet.
Dr. Shabazz, what is your contact information, and do you have any other things that you would like to mention to our listeners?
Oh, sure. People can reach me at Shabazz, S-H-A, or let me give you my Gmail, Kwame Shabazz, K-W-A-M-E, S-H-A-B-A-Z-Z, @gmail.com.
At gmail.com. Okay.
Gmail. Yeah, I'm going to send you a couple of links, Doc. I think you'd be interested in showing your students. I've done a lot of work at Bowie State and Howard University and Morgan State, and so yeah, I'm appreciative of your scholarship, man. We need more of you. I mean, really,
thank you.
We just do, man. It's so much that we don't know, and our history has been hidden from us, and so that's why I'm in love with Leslie Gist and the Gist of Freedom program and what we do here, because it's essential for our
absolutely,
you know, in order for us to survive.
Would you go over that historical site, Malcolm X's family owned in a historical site. Could you mention that again for our listeners?
Sure. Let's see. It's a house that was now a historical landmark, the Malcolm X House in Roxbury, which is right in Boston. And I used to know the address. I used to have the address memorized. What if you ask around? If you come to Boston and ask about the Malcolm X House, or just Google it online, you find the address there. But the house was owned by Ella Collins, which was Malcolm X's senior half sister. And so Malcolm X spent some of his formative years in that house. And it's now a historical landmark that's owned by, or last I heard, it was owned by Malcolm X's nephew, Rodney L. Collins, who was Ella Collins' son.
So how did it other than Malcolm X living there, did it qualify otherwise as a historical site?
Well, that's history. Yeah, the history was, that this great man, spent some of his formative years in Boston. He spent time in Boston this was before his Malcolm X days, but then he comes back to Boston, and depending on who you ask, some say that he was the one who established the mosque in Boston, Mosque No. 11, Muhammad's Mosque No. 11. Others say, there's a debate about it, but anyhow, he was influential in establishing the Boston Mosque there, and this is where he discovered and was a mentor to Minister Louis Farrakhan in Boston also.
Wow. You see, Spike Lee didn't capture that in the movie.
Spike misses some things. He did a pretty good job, but he couldn't get everything, unfortunately.
I was saying that in jest, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Roxbury is rather historical in its own right, and that black abolitionists lived there. I think William Lloyd Garrison was there. Do you know any other historical points about Roxbury? And
is that where Christmas Addicks
was in Boston?
Right, Christmas Addicks was in Boston. He took according to some scholars, he took the first bullet for the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, New England generally was just a hotbed for liberalism and progressive whites and blacks. There's a sizable population of free blacks there, so yeah, the entire New England area was just a hotbed for resistance and anti-slavery abolitionism.
So Doc, let me ask you this: as an African American, what was it like for you to go to Harvard? What was your discipline at Harvard in the first place?
Anthropology.
So what was anthropologist?
Right, I'm trained as an anthropologist, that's right.
So what was, let me just ask you before you even go there. Do you know Dr. Cheryl LaRoche? She worked
Cheryl
on the dig, at the dig when they found the bodies buried in New York City.
No. I do cultural anthropology. We deal with living people.
Okay.
When I say anthropology, people typically think of digging, or archaeology, but I study culture.
Cultural.
Yeah, I'm a cultural anthropologist.
Interesting. So what was it like at Harvard?
That would be a whole nother show.
Yes, I think that would be, and maybe one day we can come on and discuss that. But, gentlemen, I think we're about out of time. In fact, we are out of town. I want to thank you again, Dr. Kwame Shabazz, for being our guest here today, along with Ty Gray L. And
my pleasure.
Yeah, the engineer says it's time to cut it, and I think I want to say good night.
It's my
goodnight.
Pleasure
okay.
as well.
Thanks a lot, brother. Good talking to you.
Okay.
You too.
Right.
And always in
parting.
Don't
forget, come next week now for Chapter 4, Thursday night.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know what the date is, but we'll be back with Chapter 4 next week.
Yes.
Okay, gentlemen?
Peace.
Yes. My pleasure.
Take care. All right. Bye-bye. Good night.